My name is Dee Bechtel. This is a session on abortion, euthanasia, and the death penalty. And I guess I could have included war in there also. The subtitle is, Are We the Murderers? Being a lawyer, I might be accused of the old saying that logic is the hobgoblin of little minds. And the people that we can accuse of that are primarily lawyers, theologians, and philosophers. But maybe at Holden, that includes all of us. So I hope we're all at least theologians and philosophers. And what I wanted us to do tonight is to consider the interrelationships of these social issues that all involve killing in some way. Please feel free to interrupt any time. I don't have any particular agenda. I have some idea where I'd like us to go and have some ideas about what subtopics I'd like to include in this discussion, but feel free to jump in at any time with a question or a comment of your own. The basis for the germ that got this workshop going was, it seems to me that something is basically out of sync or not logical when you say, and I think there are people in our society now that are saying, I oppose abortion, but I'm in favor of the death penalty, and I'm in favor of militarism, armaments, nuclear war. That doesn't make sense to me, because I think that killing is basically killing. If we can justify it in some situations, why can't we justify it in all situations? Or if we can't justify it in any situation, then we need to say so as a society. Some basic statistics just on the death penalty. My research indicates that there are 37 states that now have capital punishment laws. As a matter of fact, I'm rather ashamed to say that my state of Oregon passed an initiative which put capital punishment back on the law, made it back in as an effective law in our state by a margin of about 8-1. That was really distressing to me. The controversy within the punishment, if we're talking about the death penalty, is now not over whether we should have a death penalty or not, so much as what are acceptable ways for administering the death penalty. And there's controversy over whether a certain drug used for lethal injections is, according to the Federal Drug Administration, prompt and painless. Well, that seems to me a little strange, too, because if we're talking about that lethal injection as opposed to electrocution, it would seem to me that the drug is going to be considerably more prompt and painless, at least what I know about the drug. Are firing squads prompt and painless? Are gas chambers prompt and painless? As far as I know, in France, the guillotine is still a method of execution. No, you say it isn't. Oh, okay. All right. So it's been within the past few years then that it's been outlawed. But I can hardly imagine that the use of the guillotine is prompt and painless. And I think we could also go so far as to argue that life imprisonment may not be a prompt and painless or even an effective method of punishment either. The question is, how can we justify using these methods of punishment? Do we really want the death penalty? Are we really saying that we want humane punishment for people who are accused usually capital punishment is, in most states, I believe, a punishment that is limited to very serious forms of murder, usually multiple murders or murder of a police officer, for example. That seems to be more important than murder of an ordinary citizen, whatever logic you choose to use about that.
Yeah, the Rosenbergs.
Okay, I don't know a whole lot about the Rosenbergs. I'm showing my age, and I have not studied that period of history. Can you tell briefly about that?
I don't think the crime that they committed was considered to be a capital offense anymore.
What was their crime? Was treason.
It was at the height of the McCarthy.
Okay.
Era, a lot of it was hysterical kind of
stuff.
It was a miscarriage of justice. One of the few times I can think of in recent history when our country has used capital punishment for less than aggravated murder.
But there was a lot of racial overtones of that as well, were there not?
Well, communist mostly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Supposedly it passed down some information regarding nuclear missiles that America was developing at that time through the Russians, supposedly. And there was the McCarthy era, the witch hunt, and he was trial and convicted. And later on, his son wrote a book, and it was disputed, some of the evidence that was brought out against him. So, you know, not clear that he really did anything. The trial that he was put on was quite biased at the time. It's clear that he did not get the trial.
And that's one of the main points that's being raised by people now who are opposed to capital punishment, is that the statistics are that people who are on death row awaiting execution, in most cases, are a large percentage of them are minorities, chiefly blacks, and poor people. And so what the death penalty has become in our society, at least if you look at statistics, is that it's the punishment that people who can't afford the high-priced lawyer are getting. And I really question whether that's justice, if we are only putting to death the people who are not white and not Anglo-Saxon and who don't have much money. That isn't a humane or fair method of punishment either.
What about these temporary insanity cases? What do you think of them?
The temporary insanity laws differ a lot from state to state. And, okay, in general, my opinion is that the insanity defense can be a valid defense. I think it also can be overworked, and I think you may be, perhaps you're thinking what comes to my mind in when we're talking about the insanity defense was what was most sensationally publicized in the newspapers most recently was the person who, I forget his name, who attempted the assassination of President Reagan. Hinckley, thank you. That seemed to me a miscarriage of justice as well. It seemed to me that Hinckley could afford, his parents could afford, a lot of very high-priced psychiatrists who came and testified at great length in the courtroom. That may also be a defense that is largely has become available to the rich because poor people simply can't afford high-priced psychiatrists as expert witnesses to come into the courtroom and testify, yes, this person has a problem with mental disease or defect. Generally, the mental disease or defect business and having a history of mental illness is a real requirement for anyone to show, to be able to support this insanity defense. The theory behind it, I think, is valid. I think that there are people who, if they truly did not know what they were doing, deserve to have that fact brought out in court. But again, it becomes an inequitably administered law because it takes a lot of money to bring in a lot of high-priced psychiatrists in order to testify.
Another thing I'm liking is this. If a person is able to think and do it, they should be able to think what is right and what is right and what is wrong.
Mm-hmm. That's a very valid criticism of it, right. And it's pretty difficult. Usually a trial happens probably a year after the event itself, to have someone come in and be able to testify that at the time of that act, a person truly didn't know right from wrong, or didn't know what they were doing, is pretty skeptical. Usually, the psychiatrists haven't seen the person who's accused of the crime until, at the very least, I would guess, maybe a week or so after the act itself. It's pretty difficult to ascertain what exactly that person's mental state was at the time of the crime. And that leads to some of the injustice, I agree. One of the other aspects of this, if we can then jump over to the question of, euthanasia in a sort, was the case of Baby Jane Doe that was in all of our papers fairly recently. Baby Jane Doe was the baby that was born, I believe it was with spina bifida, an open spine condition, that the parents had made the decision in consultation with the doctors that the baby should not be should not undergo surgery, is my understanding, which would have been quite painful and perhaps even required a series of surgeries, in order, but that the child would be allowed to die as painlessly as possible. I imagine that the hospital people were administering pain medication. The people that objected to that were the Right to Life groups, who came in and said, no, you must do everything possible to preserve the life of this baby for as long as possible. Now, those parents were forced to go to, I'm sure, a great deal of expense, not only hospital expense, but legal expenses, in order to fight for their right to make the decision for their child. And what ultimately happened was that the parents won. The parents were allowed to make the decision for what they felt was right for their baby, and the baby did not have the surgery. But this gets us into the question of how far should we go with this thing? Who has the right to decide what extraordinary methods, what extraordinary medical procedures ought to be administered? And we got into this, for those of you who were here, what was it, two nights ago, when we had the panel on medical ethics a bit, we got into the euthanasia question. I'd like to push that a step further and talk about what some people have termed active euthanasia as opposed to passive euthanasia. Now, with the Baby Jane Doe case, the question was, should we do something to prevent death? The active euthanasia question is, can we do something to induce death? Some of the cases about this that have been in the news media recently were things like a quadriplegic who was in a hospital and she was arguing, I have the right to starve myself to death. I have the right to refuse eating, which was being provided her by hospital personnel. The hospital people were arguing, no, we have the right to force feed you in order to keep you alive. And the case was ultimately decided, I understand, that the hospital people had the right to force feed her. And my recollection is that this person ultimately changed her mind and said, yes, I want to keep on eating. And I'm not sure what went into that change of opinion on her part.
She went to Mexico and she couldn't find a hospital there that would let her do it either. And finally, after all that, I think she just gave up and decided to quit trying.
Yes.
I have a problem with the legal word in that case of the right. And I don't think, I would look at it if I was a hospital administrator, rather than using the right to force feed, is the obligation to preserve that person's life using, you know, whatever means necessary if that person is in care. I like the word obligation.
The obligation under the Hippocratic Oath, is that what you're referring to?
Well, not even under the Hippocratic Oath, but I mean, it's a little incongruous that, you know, we use that term that, you know, allow someone to die rather than, I mean, that's not what hospitals are in the business of doing. And we talked about that the other night, too, but in the case of allowing a person to commit suicide, basically, I don't think that it comes down to rights, it's just that we have the obligation as a society to preserve life wherever we can.
Okay, then does it make a difference, if I can pick on you a bit, does it make a difference then if a person is not in a hospital setting? Do we as a society have an obligation not to allow people to choose death?
Well, in that case, we really don't have any means of stopping someone. It's like, I'm a police officer. And many times I've come upon people that are suicidal in the course of my work. And it's my obligation, not my right, it's my obligation to preserve that, or do everything I can to preserve that person's life. However, if I don't know about that person and that person goes and picks up a loaded gun, puts it to their head and blows their head off, there's nothing I can do and I don't bear any sense of guilt. If, however, I fall short of doing everything that I can to stop that person from committing suicide, I have not lived up not only to my obligation as a police officer, but my own obligation as a Christian. By not interceding.
Donald,
well, the thing that struck me about that case of that woman that seemed so unfair on her part was that she was expecting them, and since she was asking somebody else to do to her what she wanted to do. She wanted to go out, but she wasn't content to find a way to do that on her own and not cause somebody else some guilt in the process. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a real selfish thing on her part to want to go into a hospital setting and expect a lot of people around her to go through this process with her, and you know what are the reasons for that? You know, could be a lot of ramifications for that. But I just don't think she had the right to ask a lot of other people to help her do something. If she wanted to do that, she could just as well have found a way to do that quietly without having to go through that, expecting somebody else to do it for her.
I forget now why she thought she had to be in the hospital.
She was in because of other medical problems. She had severe decubitus ulcers.
She wanted to be comfortable. Several people offered their homes apparently for her to do, for her to die in a home situation that she wasn't in.
She was in the hospital already at the time, though, wasn't she? I thought she was in, not because of that, but she. I think part of it was depression induced by her, you know, her physical condition. She had, you know, severe bed sores.
Yes.
What about in case of comatose patients who have no hope of coming back? Is that considered euthanasia to unplug the machine, so to speak?
That was one of the questions that we got into on the panel, and briefly, my understanding is that once the life-sustaining machines are in place, then doctors have an obligation to do everything they can in order to keep that life going. The question that we were dealing with on the panel was the question about hooking up the machines, hooking up the person to the machines in the first place. Generally, my understanding is that, well, in the Karen Ann Quinlan case, which was also mentioned the other night, the doctors were arguing that they had the obligation as has been argued, to keep her life going. The parents were saying, no, we want her taken off the life support systems, and I believe the parents won. They were given the right to take her off the life support systems. In my understanding, she has not yet regained consciousness, but she is living now without the life support systems. She is sustaining life on her own. Yes?
Well, I think it's pretty much accepted that a person can specify for themselves that no heroic efforts be made, you know, to keep them alive. Of course, the thing with a baby, what's happened a number of times is that if the baby has been born severely deformed or something, there's just been no attention paid to the baby, and then the baby has died. But actually, I think that's really not right, because it's no baby, of course, can live on his own without attention of some kind, and that's actively somebody is actively involved by lack of proper care, I think, in aiding the death of the baby.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically saying not to do something in the case of a helpless infant is doing something, is active euthanasia.
Yeah.
Good point.
In the case of the baby Bill, it's kind of different. That probably is, you know, kind of an unfortunate situation for both the parents and the hospital concerned, but it points up what is the outlook for the child if any attention is given to the condition or any treatment offered. And in the case of spina bifida, the parents were told that there was a possibility that this child may not live if not given attention. But the other side of the story was not given, that many spina bifida infants lived into adulthood. They have normal intelligence, they are handicapped, and part of the reporting in that case was really bad on the part of the news media. They distorted facts, or they didn't quote facts completely, and what I feel it comes down to in the case of an infant, it becomes a matter of convenience for the parents rather than a true choice about that child's life. It's easy for parents to be in a position, knowing the stress that they would go through in raising a child, the extra attention that child would require on their part, but that doesn't take into account that child may in fact itself, if it were able to make a decision about its own life, choose to live and choose to live with its own handicap. Mm-hmm. And I disagree with any parent being given the option in a case where a child may have a disability and yet may be able to lead what it feels to be a full life, not being given the chance to grow to the point where it can make that decision.
This line of thinking also gets us into the question about parents' right to refuse medical treatment for children. For instance, there have been cases recently about, people, if I can classify them as fundamentalist Christians, who believe that their doctors should not provide healing, God provides healing. So therefore, these parents taking that attitude say, I have the right then to use prayer as the only healing method that will be administered to my children, and have refused medical treatment of various sorts for their children. And generally, they have won on the grounds of religious freedom, that they have, as parents, have the right to make religious decisions for their children, which ultimately end up being health decisions as well.
But haven't there been just as many decisions on in favor of the, I guess you'd call it, the child or the medical establishment too? I think cases where Jehovah's Witnesses don't allow transfusions, and yet children have to have surgery, and the surgery requiring transfusions, and the courts have said that the religious beliefs aren't a valid reason.
There have been some cases that have decided, particularly on life-threatening situations, if this situation is a life-threatening one. However, as far as I know, the more recent cases have come down on the side of the religious freedom question, that parents have the right to refuse medical treatment for their children on the grounds of religious freedom. Is that... do you agree with that? Is that part of what ought to be?
I agree with you there, but I think Christian Science is putting it that way. Public television was a story called Lady Asher. She was a Christian Science, and her daughter was very got injured in a horse accident, and was killed by a horse. Mm-hmm. And her father told the doctor to go ahead and give her this medication. And she went right straight in the air. And something like that, you know. And it's hard for a doctor to walk into an office, I think, like a hospital bed, and see a person suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't give it no painkiller like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, it'd be hard on him. And something like that, I said, no hard on him.
Right. Well, in the position, though, of these people that want to refuse medical treatment, they're saying, we don't belong in the hospital at all. We shouldn't be in a hospital. We should have the right to take our child home and pray for this child for healing.
I wonder if anyone's ever followed a case history of where children were taken care of in spite of their parents and even themselves, given transfusions and so on. Mm-hmm. Are they accepted back into the community, or are they marked forever as being lost, or what happens to them?
I don't know the answer to that. I have not followed one of those situations to that extent.
I would think it would depend on a particular congregation. I think I did a study once in Jehovah's Witnesses, and I found that there was a little bit of difference between the orthodoxy of the one group compared to the other group. And I suppose that's probably would be the situation.
A children's hospital that I worked at, we routinely had cases like that come up, especially because we did a lot of pediatric cardiac surgery. And the Jehovah's Witnesses would, they would pursue it far enough, and if we'd have a trial and the judge would just come to the hospital. The case was always, at least all the ones that I had heard, were always decided in favor of the child receiving the transfusion, and as soon as the parents had the formality of that being required, that was just the end of it. It was dropped and nothing more was said about it. And when the transfusions would take place or whatever, no mention would be made of the fact.
Oh, I see. So you're saying
at that time
that they would accept then the judge's decision as what they had to follow.
It was like for them that they pursued it as far as they could, and then it was just dropped.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting then. So that would almost encourage then the civil law section in order to get involved in this, because you're saying then, all you need to do is get a judge in there and make the arguments before the judge, and the judge then orders the transfusion, and then...
They haven't sinned.
Yeah, right. You're relieving that decision, relieving everyone from that decision.
I think one thing that you have to look at in this, in all of these issues, is what is the ultimate value that you're trying to preserve? Are you trying to preserve life no matter what? And people make a god out of life.
Mm-hmm.
Or are you trying to preserve quality of life? Or freedom of choice, freedom of religion. You have to somehow get down to the basic question of what is your ultimate value? Where is your God?
Mm-hmm.
And what I hear some people saying when they discuss this issue is that life is sacred no matter what. And I don't happen to put life as my God. My God makes me make choices between life and other freedoms. And you have to decide them sometimes on an individual basis. And so I think you really have to decide where your ultimate value is. And this goes all the way back to the abortion issue and so on too.
Mm-hmm.
Is it life or is it quality of life? And the argument of when life starts is sort of a mute point at that point. You know, you still have to decide at some point whether you're going to be, you can sort of fool yourself by arguing that it's not really life or it is life, but you have to make that decision on quality of life, freedoms, fullness of God in all of creation, trying to maximize that, create unity in creation is probably what we should really be aiming for, and we as humans are never going to be able to do that fully. And to say that no matter what you're going to try and preserve life is creating life into a God.
Good point.
That also allow one to, as you began saying that, as I find myself agreeing with, if I'm against abortion, I'm also against capital punishment and against nuclear armament. But I find myself in a similar position as Grace saying, when I get into a discussion about making choices, quality of life, and so on, then I find myself saying, well, maybe I can't accept abortion or I can't accept capital punishment. Does that kind of a discussion follow what you're saying?
Sure. In my opinion, it does, yes. And that's the bottom line. Whether life itself is the ultimate value, or if there's something else, that's the ultimate value. Yes?
Well, once you start, as far as abortion is concerned, or capital punishment or anything, and then you start playing God when you start making these choices. The quality of life, who's going to determine this? I think really that only God, he's the only one that can create life. So, I think that we delude ourselves when we think that we can determine it. At just what point is this life worth saving and this life not worth saving?
Well, we have to make those decisions.
No, we don't.
Yes, we do.
No, we don't.
I'll give you a case where you have to make a decision.
Okay.
You have a pregnant mother who's having trouble with the pregnancy, and if the infant is going to survive, you're going to have, if you're not going to intervene in some way, sometimes you have to kill the baby to save the mother. Or you lose both.
I think
in that case, you have
rare.
To make a positive action of killing an infant.
I think you do the very best you can to save both lives. And
sometimes you cannot do that.
Well, you do the very best. Well, you should always do the very best you can to save both lives. And I don't think...
Sometimes you can't do that.
Well, I disagree. I think you can always do that. The very best you can. Save both lives.
Greg, you as a doctor, though, you're gonna take every step that you know how to save those lives. And if it comes down to a situation where you can't, you're going to make that choice with the mother over which life she wants to save, though, aren't you? Aren't you going to consult with her?
And sometimes you have to decide which one. And that's why you try and do as much as you can, as you are physically able and technically able to do, to try and save both people. But in certain situations, you cannot save both.
Corey, you're talking about a very small fraction of a percentage of the abortions, though, that occur that would fall into that category, though. And I think that is possible to have something happen like you say, but it's extremely rare. And you can just do the very best you can under those circumstances.
You know, you can come up with all kinds of situations. You know, you get into how many people in a life raft, and you've got food and water for maybe two people, and you've got five people in a life raft, and you've got to either all die or maybe you can save two. Those situations do come up, and we can't avoid making decisions. We have to make some of those decisions, and whether that's playing God, I don't think that's playing God. I think that's accepting our responsibility as human beings and having to make some decisions sometimes. And they're hard decisions, and we're going to suffer for some of them, but we're trying to make the right decision, trying to create as much, and like in the Bible study this morning in Ephesians, we're trying to create as much unity as we can but we can't always do the whole thing. We can't, you know, we aren't going to be living in perfect wholeness. We can't do it all.
I'd like to add to Greg's statement too. I'm a police officer, and I am against capital punishment, but yet in the course of my duties, I shot and killed a 19-year-old prison escapee who pulled a gun on myself and another officer, and he began pulling the trigger. His gun misfired twice, but during the course of his pulling the trigger, I was pulling the trigger and I shot and killed him. And yet, if he had shot and killed my partner, I still would have been against his, and I had been unable to, you know, I had shot and killed him. I would not have supported his execution. But it was a matter, there was a decision of, he was acting out of a criminal intent to take the life of my partner, mm-hmm. another officer. And I feel that's one of those choices that Greg is talking about. I think it's probably a little clearer than, case. I support justified homicide when it comes down to a matter of protecting Steve's life here or your life from a criminal assault, but I don't believe in taking the life of that person if in fact I can intervene and stop the assault and ultimate death of you mm-hmm. or Steve.
Mm-hmm. And I think the years on death row are as horrendous as the actual execution almost.
Well, I've been around prisons. I worked extraditions for 2.5 years, and believe me, prisons are not a pleasant place to be. Even the best prisons are terrible places to be. But I feel that there are some cases that lock the door, throw away the key, feed them well, give them plenty of games to play or whatever they want to do, but just don't, some of these people don't belong back out in society. Support them all the way. Let them die in prison of their own, by natural death. I would want to be the executioner myself that, pushes the button, throws the switch, or injects the lethal injection.
I might also toss into that discussion that, now I don't know this of, from my personal knowledge, but I read an article in a law review that says the statistics are that people who are the executioners, the people in the prisons whose job it is to throw the switch or to give the lethal injection or whatever, have an incredibly high rate of suicide. Those people with those kinds of decisions, and I would suspect that also might include police officers, whose job it is on a regular basis to make those kinds of decisions about my life or yours, that really are very much disturbed.
You know, we're asked not to judge, lest we be judged. And of course, I just think that self-preservation is a little bit of a different situation than making a judgment, even the life raft situation. Who is going to decide at what point whose quality of life is better than someone else's quality of life? I think that we're trying to play God when we do that, and I think that it's clear in the Bible that we're not to do that. If we do, then we're going to be judged accordingly.
To hitchhike to what you were saying, my problem with euthanasia, especially in the case of infants, is where do we stop? Is next step? Are we going to include the deaf? Are we going to include the CP? Are we going to include the retarded kids? Where do we stop? And I have a lot of problems with that. And I have a nephew who is blind, and he's somewhat autistic, and I think his life is as much value as mine and as anyone in this room. And I get very uncomfortable when people talk about that.
That's where you have to struggle with the issue each time and not make blanket statements that are then say, this is the way, it's either all black or all white. And this is part of being created in the image of God, is that we do have the obligation to make decisions. not necessarily to pass judgment on somebody, but we are in an obligation, and God created us with this term free will to be able to make decisions, and unfortunately he also made it so we had to struggle in order to do those things. And hopefully we'll never get to the point where we're going to eliminate anybody who's not perfect. But there's certain times when, like in the infant euthanasia, there are certain infants that you just know are not going to live, infants that are born with no head, just gross deformities. And to not do anything to those children is sometimes a blessing, rather than to see them suffer for any longer period of time. And it's not pleasant, but you have to make those decisions. And to preserve a life that's not really a life, you have to make that decision, I guess, sometime. And it's very difficult.
You're talking about an infinitesimal small percentage, that the type of argument that's used for the vast majority of the abortions. So, 99.9 or 99.5, I don't know, it's well up there. There's nothing wrong with the fetus, except that it's the parent's choice because of inconvenience or...
Well, I'm deliberately staying away from abortion because that's a little bit different kind of issue. I'm talking about the infants that have been born in a natural setting that have had 9 months of pregnancy. You get also another thing. Dee probably remembers this case in California, which is the opposite way, in that there was a deformed child born who had a guardian appointed, and the guardian sued the parents of that child for not aborting the child, and they won.
It was a miscarriage of justice.
Who won?
That child won the lawsuit against his parents for not being aborted.
As a matter of fact, Roger Harms is not here tonight, but he was saying that the conclusion that he's forced to come to is that if there's a question about, just a very slight variance in medical procedure, one would kill a child, or perhaps an unborn fetus, the other would allow that child to be born but deformed. The medical malpractice damages are much greater if he allows that child to be born than if the child is killed. Now that says something rather drastic about where our priorities are as well. Again, maybe we're caught up in the system and there's not anything any of us can do about that fact, but that's a disturbing fact to me. Yes, up there on the balcony.
In the beginning, you alluded to the idea of connecting the three titles of this, the euthanasia, capital punishment, and abortion. It's basically capital punishment and abortion. Could you expound on that yourself? I haven't really heard where you're coming from that, except what you said at the beginning.
Okay, basically what I said at the beginning is that's the basis for the discussion, is I'm concerned that we can't really say we're in favor of prolonging life at any cost and then going to say, I guess what I see, the contradiction that I see is people that say, I am opposed to abortion, but I'm in favor of the death penalty. That just doesn't make sense to me, and I'm not sure I, as a Christian at least, can. Okay, but in society approving deaths, some deaths and not others, whose society? I mean, I don't believe we can abandon responsibility for the laws in our society. We have an obligation, I have an obligation to see that the laws that govern me and other people in my society are ones that I agree with, and I have an obligation to do whatever I can within the legislative or the enforcement process to make those laws just and justly enforced. Yes?
I think that somehow this discussion always makes clear to me what a terrible indictment all these issues show us, show up against our culture. That is, why couldn't the paraplegic stand life because we made life intolerable? It seems to me that there's a classic argument about capital punishment that goes something like, was it Camus or Sartre? Somebody help me. That says the only real reason for capital punishment, for arguing for capital punishment, was economics. It cost more to keep them in prison than it did to kill them. That was that was written in like the turn of the century, I believe.
And that's
now reversed. So it costs more now to carry through with the court systems and kill them, or I should say, bring them into punishment capitally, than it does to house them.
They usually want to have to die, too. That's been generally the case.
One of the interesting ironies that you mentioned that, the statement about the state of Oregon voted 8-1 to restore capital punishment. They also voted down a bond issue of some $50 million to increase prison funding, which would alleviate prison overcrowding and deteriorated conditions for prisoners. So, I mean, you know.
Well, in California, we vote on things like to increase prison facilities, but we vote down school bonds. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that say that we haven't got our heads screwed up right about quality of life anyway. So who's going to straighten out that big mess?
But don't they say capital punishment is a deterrent?
Oh, well, whatever. But what I wonder is it really a matter of economics that we choose, say, that we say something about abortion, that we say something about euthanasia, that we say something about capital punishment, or how is it that we can begin to say something about quality of life and mean more than just a matter of convenience for our families? It's terrible in our society to be on the fringe of physical health or acceptance or anything else. It's a terrible indictment about our society.
Or helplessness, like the newborn baby or the fetus is a helpless person that's unable to make a decision. And of course, this, you know, like the poor and the minorities that end up usually the victims of capital punishment. So it's we tend to take advantage of the weakest among us, and that doesn't say much for our society.
Well, doesn't the matter of pain enter in here? Even with the paraplegic, wasn't it her painful existence as much as her handicap?
There's all kinds of things. She was just recently divorced. She was going through all kinds of other things, and she was asking a health institution to help her in her suicide, which I think is basically ridiculous. It seems to me one of the things I think that I'd like to say is I think that we tend to sentimentalize life. I'm not so sure that we really are concerned about quality, but we sentimentalize the value of life and really don't talk about quality at all. So that, for instance, in Kurt Vonnegut's play, I don't know how many of you are Kurt Vonnegut fans, if you ever get a chance to read Fortitude. We put that on up here once. But Fortitude is a piece of black humor. That is, everything is exaggerated to an incredible degree. And the scene opens and the woman has her head on a tripod and everything is hooked up to various machines and things, and there's a doctor that is at the console and he plays her life. You know, and it's ridiculous, and that's a kind of sentimentality. Life, any kind of life, any shred of life is worth it ad infinitum, forever. You know, if the eye goes wrong, you get a Westinghouse eye or whatever.
Yeah. How many of us know what agonies that woman was going through mentally and spiritually and physically? How many of us have been in her shoes? What's that saying about, let me not judge any man unless I walk green moons and his moccasins? How many of us know how a doctor feels when he has to make a decision between a mother and a child? That's an individual decision. And in a sense, that doctor is suffering the suffering of Christ. Father, forgive us. You know? I think we talk in these generalities, and we talk in percentages. People aren't percentages. They're not generalities. Mm-hmm. They're human beings.
And we have a tendency, in my opinion, to forget those sorts of things because we deal in the economics of the situation, yeah, or the statistics. You know, it's easy to forget individuals in that. I agree.
The problem is that two different doctors. One doctor will do the very best he can because he believes that he should always do that. The other doctor may say that the quality of life doesn't warrant me to do the best that I can in this situation. See, that's the question. I think the latter tends to be blaming God when he does that.
Isn't it a case of choosing the lesser of two evils and having to live with one's conscience and suffering through that?
Well, I think myself, I'm pro-life. I mean, and as soon as there's conception, it's all a matter of time and maturity. All of us were at that same point at one time. And after we're born, there's a number of months and years that we are pretty helpless. That's the way human beings are. And I think that we shouldn't assist people in suicide. We should, to the ability that we have, we need to do the very best to preserve life. I don't think that we should be making decisions on it. Now, there's no question that one doctor may have more skill than another doctor. You know, and that I don't think that should be debated at all. A doctor or anybody else should just do the best that they can, you know, with the help of God. That's all we
but,
can do.
But you're saying that if a doctor makes a decision you don't agree with, then he's not doing his best.
No, not
I think that two doctors can come to two absolutely opposite decisions, and yet each is doing his best.
There's a concept in law known as the concept of reasonable cause. I, as a police officer, may have reasonable cause to believe this person committed a crime, and I can articulate those reasons. And Steve over here, another policeman, may have suspicions and may go on, but they may not be able to see all the same evidence that I do. And yet the court may uphold me, and yet in exactly the same case, turn his appeal down. And I think what we're talking about, if in the judgment of, you know, several people, in the case of a case like a baby Jane Doe, that they feel that this child is not going to live, you have to go along with what they say. I have a case study that is a similar case to baby Jane Doe. In fact, I've talked to the grandparents of these people. They're good friends of my family. The grandparents of a child was born 3 years ago with spina bifida. It also had a small head. The doctors said the chances of that child being retarded are great. The chances of that child living to adulthood were slim. And the chance of that child living in great pain was very, very high. The father and mother of the child decided to go with very conservative treatment. They said no surgery, although there was another doctor on staff that says we think you ought to at least give the child a surgery. Today that child is 3 years old. Its normal intelligence is measured by all three-year-old standards. It gets around and is in no apparent pain. And, you know, for any parent to say, you know, about a child that's an infant, no, I won't treat that child when it has a chance of making its own decision about its own life.
Thank you for coming.